It's been a while, but the Podium Game Podcast is back. I'm Brian Gibberman here with Jared Dubin, and we are going to do a three-part 2015-2016 NBA preview in our own unique way. Jared, what's going on?
Not too much, man. Thanks for having me. We're doing this sort of as an audio component to the HP preview, which just dropped this morning at the same time that we're dropping these, so it should be fun.
And the preview, you can. Why don't you give the information out on where you could go get that?
Sure. We're going to have the link up on Hardware Paroxysm. You can get it right there. It'll be available through Jumac for, I believe, $5. It's 400 pages. There are three sections from Hardwood Paroxysm writers on each team, plus a section from Nylon Calculus on each team, plus a section from Upside and Motor on the young players in each of the six divisions, plus a roundtable about each of the six divisions, one about the rookies and one about sort of random grab bag topics. There are, I believe, 8 or 9 long-form pieces. There's a piece of art about every single team, plus cover on back of the preview art as well. 400 pages total, predictions, all different kinds of stuff. There's fan fiction. It's got a Western theme, so all of the sections of each team are a Western-themed kind of thing where, you know, there's 3-10 to Yuma, there's Justified, there's the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, the Three Amigos, City Slickers, True Grit, the Treasure of Sierra Madre, Little Big Man, Deadwood, the Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, the Outlaw Josie Wells, and Firefly. Those are the names of all of the different sections that we're doing. So there's a whole lot of stuff in there. And, you know, as usual, it's the great stuff that you get from HP's writers.
All right, very good. And I have my copy. I can't wait to dig into it. I hope I have a chance to. I hope I have time to this weekend in between football. But looking forward to all that. I haven't taped the podcast in so long. I forgot how terribly I put together my chair at my desk and how uncomfortable it is. Jesus.
I'm sitting in a great chair right now. I actually just got new furniture in my apartment because there was not a lot of room to maneuver around with the old stuff because I moved from a place where I had sort of a spare room that I turned into an office into a place where I don't. So I got some new stuff, and I had a whole lot more room now.
Well, thanks for taunting me. Appreciate it. Well, my chair isn't as... The Eastern Conference is better than my chair, so let's start there, which is saying something.
Is it? Is the Eastern Conference better than your chair?
Yes, my chair is that bad. The Eastern Conference is better than it. All right, so how we're going to do this preview, we're going to do part one, which is now, we're going to do the Eastern Conference. We're going to break it into tiers. Contender, potential playoff team, automatic lottery team. Now, for me in the East, the breakup's really kind of strange. I'm curious to see. I have a feeling. I wonder if we're going to be different or the same on this. Let's start with the contender. I only have one.
Or do you want to start with the lottery teams?
You want to start with the You want to start with the lottery teams? Okay. I only have one.
Really?
Yeah.
I am very much the opposite.
See, I think this is how I did it. I think there's only one guaranteed lottery team. I think
so we did it a little bit differently. So I did it where it was structured as, you know, these are the teams that are contenders. These are the teams that are actual real playoff teams that would make the playoffs, in any version of life. And then these are teams that should be lottery teams, but, you know, there's probably going to be 2 or 3 of them that will actually make the playoffs.
Okay, yeah, I did it. I did a guaranteed contender, guaranteed lottery team, and then I pretty much think almost every single team in the East has a chance to make the playoffs.
So I'm guessing that Philly is your team that's definitely not going to make the playoffs.
Yes, that would be the only one I have as a definite.
They are also on my list of lottery teams.
Now, who else?
I actually have teams that I consider lottery teams. But I would imagine that three or four of them will be in position for the final playoff spot.
So which, let's go, give me the other teams that you also think are guaranteed lottery teams but aren't going to make the playoffs before you go to the ones you think could be in the mix.
Okay, so I think that Philly, Charlotte, the Knicks, and the Nets are for sure lottery teams.
Let's start with Charlotte. I like them a little bit more than you do. I think they're a nice... I think Charlotte's a potential bounce-back team from last year.
I might have thought that if MKG wasn't essentially out for the year.
Oh, yeah. Damn it.
I think that kills their defense, and I don't think they have enough offensively to be even average, which, if they're not an elite defensive team, which I don't think they can be without MKG, then there's just not enough there to get them over the hump, I don't think.
No, that's a really good point, and I kind of spaced on that, to be honest, about MKG not being there. And I know all the numbers and seeing the impact he's had on them as a team as a whole, and that is really hard to ignore. What I liked about them was I think with Batum, they get back some of that weird playmaking from an unusual position that they had with McRoberts, and he's also a good three. He helps their shooting. Would have helped their defense, and they added their biggest weakness last year was their lack of 3-point shooting, and through a variety of ways they added a lot of 3-point shooting during the offseason that I think could help them in that area, and in the East that would have put them in a position to be a team that competes for that 8th seed. But without MKG, I have no argument making them a clear lottery team.
Yeah, I was on board, with every single thing you said. But then you look at their numbers from last year, they were 10.8 points per 100 possessions better with MKG on the floor overall. Almost 8 points on defense, just under 3 points on offense even. They went from the best defense in the league to a bottom 7 defense when MKG came off the floor. There's just no way they can make up for not having him. There are a few guys on that team that I like. I like Cody Zeller. I thought he showed some really interesting things last season. He was another guy who, they were a lot better with him on the floor than when he was off. I do like Batum, like you said. They've got some interesting dudes. But I just don't see it without MKG.
The team I would probably make the second worst team in the East is the Nets. Now, if everything absolutely clicked for them, they still have Joe Johnson, Lopez, and Thaddeus Young. If everything went absolutely right, I could see them still competing for that 8th spot, but I tend to gear more towards them being in the lottery than competing. But I did think if everything broke perfectly, they could be okay.
Yeah, I think that there's a scenario where they make the playoffs because those three guys stay healthy and play extremely well all year. I just don't think that's the most likely scenario.
It's just, with the East, it's not out of the question that a 34-35 win team, maybe 37, gets into the playoffs. And figuring out which one of these teams that is meh pulls that off is hard.
Yeah, I think that there's the other four teams are more likely. I would imagine they're all in your quote-unquote possible playoff teams.
Yeah.
So those four for me, and I've talked enough about the Knicks on other podcasts, and we've talked enough about the Knicks that everybody pretty much knows our thoughts on that team.
Yeah, and I'll do something with, I always have Herring on before the season, so I'll cover the Knicks on that.
Yeah, the four teams that, talent-wise, are probably lottery teams, but because they're in the East, I think can contend to the playoffs, are Boston, Indiana, Detroit, and Orlando.
All right, say that again. So Boston, Indiana, Detroit, Orlando, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's start with Orlando. My basic concern with Orlando, and I like a lot of their young talent. Hezonja contributing right away is a thing that, as much as I like him long term, is something I'm worried about. I like Fournier more than most people as a player, but I just don't know if they have enough shooting to make that jump yet.
I think they're going to get weird. Not necessarily in terms of the way they run their offense and stuff, but more they're just going to have some weird lineups that don't necessarily seem like they should work offensively, but they get by because, you know, love them or hate them, Scott Skiles teams play defense. We'll get to this in our predictions podcast as well, because I have something on this, but in his first year taking over a new team, Scott Skiles' teams, on average, jumped 12 spots in defensive efficiency. That would bring them up from one of the worst teams in the league on defense last year to, you know, league average or better.
I'm very much with you there. I trust that he is going to make Orlando a much better defensive team, and I think Aaron Gordon will be in the middle of that in a big way.
Between Gordon and then Oladipo and Payton in the backcourt, I think they could do a lot of interesting things pressuring the ball. And when you do that, you shave seconds off the shot clock, and that's really valuable in terms of forcing teams into bad shots. So I think that, you know, they're going to make a jump defensively, and that's going to help them stay in contention.
Indiana is – I like their – can we join the Knicks and Indiana together? Then we'd have a good basketball team. One has too many front court pieces. The other has too many backcourt pieces.
I'm not nearly as high on Indiana as other people seem to be. I don't know who at all is going to play front court minutes for them. You know, even if Paul George plays a lot of minutes at the four, like, who else is playing in the front court for them? Like, are they going to play Miles Turner 30 minutes a night?
They have to. I mean, you're looking at it's Turner, Mahinmi, Jordan Hill, LaVoy Allen.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know where you get above average production at either forward spot from that crew. I would imagine Solomon Hill will play sort of some combo forward minutes too, maybe Chase Buttinger. But even their backcourt, which is, I guess, sort of the strength of the team other than Paul George, you know, it's George Hill, Monte Ellis, Rodney Stuckey, and then you're getting into, you know, guys that are not NBA-level players.
You know, are you not considering CJ Miles an NBA-level player, or you're not considering him a guard?
I guess I was considering him, you know, the guy that they're going to play at the three.
Okay. Yes, I think he's an NBA. Well, I think he's a rotation guy. You can get some three-point shooting out of
him. He's a rotation guy. You know, like a seventh man type.
Yeah.
Solid player. I think the same is probably true of Buttinger. I feel like other than George Hill and Ellis, they're a team of, and by George Hill and Ellis, I mean Paul George, George Hill, and Monte Ellis. They're a team of like seven seventh men. And I don't know what you do with that.
The one thing it's just, again, another team in the mix of East mediocrity. I think this is the first time in his career I feel like Monta Ellis has been paired with someone that's actually going to accentuate what he does and what he does and can't do on both ends of the court. I don't know if he's ever had that in his career before.
Yeah, George Hill is, like, if you wanted to build a backcourt player to play with Mondales, it would probably look a whole lot like George Hill.
Yep, big enough to guard twos if needed. Doesn't necessarily need the ball in his hands, but can also be a secondary ball handler. Can hit
really spot up shooter.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like the thought process behind the Monta Ellis signing when you have George Hill, I thought made a real lot of sense. And a lot of how, if they can overachieve or not, I think kind of depends on it comes down to the front court issues we talked about, and then what level of play Paul George can kind of put this team on his back and carry them to.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see whether he's able to do that. You know, I think that a lot of the reason that he was able to carry the team was because the team didn't need to be carried a couple years ago. And you saw after the first couple months of the season, when he started trying to be like a LeBron-type creator that does everything for the offense, his efficiency cratered in the second half of that season, and the whole team fell apart. Obviously, we didn't see if he'd be able to do it on a more regular basis last season because of that horrible, horrible injury. But I'm not sold yet that he's, you know, this surefire number one offensive option.
I would lean toward, and it doesn't necessarily mean he can't be the best player on a team, but I kind of agree with you that I don't necessarily think, even though he can be the best player on the team, that also doesn't mean he can be a number one offensive option. I don't think...
Right, because when you're talking about him as the best player on the team, you're including defense too, which matters a whole lot, and which he's really good at.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Boston. Another weird mix of play. These teams are really weird, man.
Yeah, I mean, the Celtics, I specifically wrote about how weird they are for the Cauldron a couple weeks ago. There's like 19 power forwards on this team. It's really weird, man.
It seems like David Lee's going to be involved an awful lot, and I don't necessarily know if that's a good thing.
I'd say for the mix they have in the backcourt and on the wing, it's a good thing because they're going to need his playmaking. And for the mix they have in the frontcourt, it's a good thing because they're going to need his rebounding. But if they want to be an above-average defensive team, it's a bad thing.
Can he do Amir Johnson or Tyler Zeller do enough on the defensive end to kind of prop him up, or they're not even close to that level?
I think it depends more, and this is a strange thing to say, but I think the roster construction works that way. It depends more on the backcourt and the wing guys to prop up lineups with Lee. When you have Smart, Bradley, and Crowder, the idea then is to stop teams from getting to Lee's defense at all by cutting off penetration at the head. And with Smart, Bradley, and Crowder, I think that they're pretty well equipped to do that.
The problem is Isaiah Thomas is also going to be playing 30 minutes a night, I'd assume, and he's not as equipped to do that as those other three are.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, you'll want to see Thomas play more with Amir Johnson and Smart play more with Lee, because that'll work in terms of both the playmaking and defense combinations.
We already at the point where we just trust Brad Stevens is going to get the best out of this roster?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had a worse roster last season. He took them to the playoffs. I think this team gets in, but, you know, in a real conference, would not.
I agree with you. The fourth team you listed for this mix was Detroit, correct?
Yes.
Now, I know they got criticized a whole bunch about the Reggie Jackson thing. I actually thought this is one of the one teams where I didn't mind him getting paid the amount he did. The key for them is how Van Gundy deals with the Reggie Jackson. I know Brandon Jennings is just getting over his Achilles injury, and I don't think he's all the way back yet, but at some point during this season, those guys are most likely both going to be healthy, and playing them together, I think, is a real issue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was one of the people that didn't exactly like giving Reggie Jackson that much money either. But Stan does get better than expected performances out of a lot of his point guards, and I think that giving him, you know, two, you know, very different pick and roll, pick and pop options in Drummond and Ilyasova, and sort of trying to replicate the Shamir Nelson, Dwight Howard, Ryan Anderson effect that he had in Orlando, I think, you know, could help him. He's not exactly a good shooter, and he didn't drive all that much either. But, you know, if he can work the in-between spaces better, just because how much attention those two guys draw with their different skill sets, I think it could work out a little bit better than I initially thought.
I think Jackson, when he's going to be running a ton of pick and roll with Drummond, will be able to get to the rim better than he has in the past. And then when you're surrounding him, not only Ilyasova, but Marcus Morris, Anthony Tolliver, Caldwell Pope, Stanley Johnson, Reggie Bullock. I mean, these are...
I really, really like Stanley Johnson. Like, there was a point last year where I was like, this guy is one of the three or four best players, and then he sort of didn't really keep that up. Or it's not so much that he didn't keep it up, then that other guys just passed him. But I like him a lot. I'm a big fan.
His preseason stuff does look good. I'm trying my hardest not to pay attention. I'm keeping tabs on it, but I'm actually...
Yeah, it's hard to not pay attention when a guy's putting up like 26-5, 12-7, 15-8, whatever it is that he's doing. It forces you to pay attention.
Yeah, but I'm like in football, I let some preseason stuff get in my head and influence me because I watched it too much. So I'm like specifically trying to avoid watching a ton of preseason basketball.
Yeah, I mean, not trying to watch too much of it, but I don't want to avoid it entirely.
Yeah, like I turn it on. I turn on the NBA TV games. I watch the Knicks. I watch the Suns if they're on TV, and then, but I'm not buying like the package yet to sit down and watch and rewatch it.
They don't even have every preseason game on the package, so.
Is that's a still a thing that's happening?
Yeah.
That's quite pathetic. It's 2015. Get yourself together, NBA. All right, so Pistons. I think they're sort of the same level.
I think they're on the same level with the Pacers, sort of.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think they're a drop below Boston. I wouldn't put them at the same level as Boston.
Yeah, there's a world where they make it, and there's a world where they don't. And I don't know which world we're going to be living in by the end of the season, because this conference is just terrible, and things could get weird.
And I already know one of the years, so now we're reaching the teams you think are lock playoff teams, right?
Yeah.
I have one I disagree on you with already.
All right, what's that one?
The Bucks.
Okay, what?
The shooting. I'm not making the same mistake I did with Charlotte with the Hornets last year. I don't think they have enough shooting to make all of this work, even though I do think Jason Kidd's a really good coach, and it is possible he can bring this all together, but I think they're going to struggle mightily on the offensive end.
I'm concerned about the shooting, too, but I think they somewhat make up for it by adding just two scorers this year. Greg Monroe can get his offense out of the post and from the elbow. It's not the most efficient thing in the world, but when the alternative is Giannis or MCW taking a jumper, it's better. They're adding back Jabari Parker, who they didn't have for most of last season. I think he played like 25 games or so. That should help give them a boost from last season. They'll know better how to work around the limitations of Carter Williams this season. I think that much like Jason Kidd used Sean Livingston in the post a ton when he was with Brooklyn, I think you're going to see that more from MCW this year, where he'll go down there and use his height and his vision to deliver passes, run some snug pick and rolls to mitigate the fact that he's not a good shooter. I think you saw that in the playoffs last year, and especially they put him and Giannis in those to minimize the fact that when they're both off the ball, you don't really have to guard them. I think that could be an interesting look for the two of them. So I think that there are ways they can work around the fact that they don't have a lot of shooting. Plus, they do have a lot of really just long-armed athletes to paper over some of the guys on the team that aren't quite as good at defenders.
And that part I do like. I like how they built the team from an athletic standpoint. and length, and that I think that's always very smart to do. I just see them being maybe one more year away and flipping out some guys to being able to get back to the playoffs.
That's fair. I mean, it's if you look at them like you looked at Charlotte the year before, I can definitely see that. I think Kidd is a really good coach that can figure out how to make it work. You know, the team is very much built in his vision for how he wants to play. I think you saw how they played Brooklyn and then how they played last year and the way this roster is constructed, and it makes sense. Between that and the conference being really bad, I think that they're, you know, are good enough to get there.
And then,
I'm also much higher on Chris Middleton than a lot of people.
I'm a big Middleton fan, too. I think he's very good. I had no problem with that contract he got. So that leaves us with the...
So you have five surefire playoff teams, then?
I would say my five... The Cavs, the Bulls, the Hawks, the Raptors, and the Wizards. The top five from last year are the only five I would say I am 100%.
Oh, so you don't have Miami as a lock either.
I have them in the playoffs. I don't think it's 100% for sure.
Injuries?
Yeah, I think it's very... The way they are, and with how Dwayne Wade is, I think it's very hard for them to form a cohesive unit when one of your top two offensive initiators plays 55 games. I think it's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, he played, what, 55, 60 games last year?
Yeah, and it's been the same thing for, what, like 3 years now that he's
been doing? No, I just mean that, you know, they got to the playoffs last year, and now they're going to have Dragic for the full season. They added Winslow. Bosch is going to be back. McRoberts presumably will be healthier. Whiteside for the whole season. I think this is a very... It's a deeper team than we think, except at two behind Wade.
And if I were to put eight playoff teams down on paper, I'd be picking the Heat as one of them.
Yeah. Like, I think this is a team that goes, like, almost 11 deep.
Kind of.
You know, Bosch and McRoberts, Whiteside and Birdman, Dang and Winslow, Wade and Gerald Green, Dragic and Chalmers, that's already 10. And then if you count, like, Udonis, Amari, and James Ennis as one, and Tyler Johnson, like, you know, that's 14 guys right there. And we'll count, you know, the 11, 12, 13, 14th guy as just one, because you can't play 14 guys.
There's,
you can't have 14 guys active, but...
There's a high floor... There's a low floor is what I'm going for, and a high ceiling.
Yeah, I would say that as long as Dragic, Dang, and Bosch are healthy, because I don't think you can count on Wade's health, I don't think you can count on Whiteside not being a moron, but if those three guys are healthy, I think they make playoffs pretty comfortably.
And Dang's health, something with his age and minutes and all that, that's something you kind of have to be concerned about with also.
Yeah, you know, obviously there were things that happened in Chicago that were not great. As it pertains to his health.
That's a kind way to put it.
I didn't know how to put it there.
You did it very gently.
So, but I think that, you know, last year, what did he play, like 70 games?
He played a good chunk of games last year, yes. But him being able to do that in back-to-back seasons is something that I would like to see. I'll have the exact amount of games in 1 second here. He played 72 games coming off a year. He played in, and then the 2 years before, he played in 63 and 63. So I would guess he probably goes back somewhere in the 60 range and over 70 again.
I'm looking at 72, 63, 75 over the last 3 years.
Oh, that's my fault. I was looking at the the separate and then the total instead of, and
yeah,
I counted
so
that as the same.
70 games ish again. I think that that's good.
Yeah. All right. So are they in the mix for that two behind Cleveland, or are you with one of the other squads?
See, I think all, not necessarily all six, I think five of the six. Like, I don't think Milwaukee's going to be the two, but I think that Washington, Atlanta, Chicago, Miami, Toronto are all potentially in the mix.
I think the team that should get it is the Wizards should be the team that it happens for this year. But that...
I am right there with you. Like, I think that, you know, if any one of those teams is really going to jump up and snatch it in a surprising way and just take control and have it all year, I think that it's them.
I would have felt more confident about that if Pierce went back. I think that was a pretty big blow for them. Ugh, I can't believe I just said that. But, they still have... Dudley comes back, gets himself healthy. Webster...
And I like the way they recovered from not retaining Pierce, and that they signed a bunch of guys who still allow them to play that small ball style.
And Randy Whitman seems to be accepting it if they play defense the right way.
Right. And it's not going to be... Like, I don't think they're going to start that way. It's not going to be their default. But I do think they'll use it more during the regular season this year than they did last year, simply because they have more than one guy that can do it for them.
Yeah.
You know, they can use Dudley there. They can use Allen Anderson there. They can slide Otto Porter there alongside Kelly Oubre. You know, Gary Neal lets them bring another guy into the backcourt. They still have Martell Webster. You know, they're deeper on the wings this year than they were last year, and that allows them to upshift more guys.
And they won 46 games last season playing non-optimal lineups all year. So,
and they sort of cratered for a part of the second half. You know, they started off so hot and, you know, didn't play quite as well after January. I think you might get sort of the opposite this year, especially if guys aren't fully healthy at the start of the season.
And then it'll be interesting to see if Beal becomes the guy that everyone thinks he's going to be, or if he just kind of stays around where he is. He's young enough that a jump is still possible. He flashed. I thought he played better in the playoffs than he did in the regular season. He was more aggressive going to the rim. But whether he can do that and stay healthy over an 82-game season is something you kind of have. That needs to be proven, and it can't be assumed.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to think of Beal in terms of what he's going to be rather than what he is right now a lot.
Good way to put it.
You know, most of us think he can get there, but that doesn't mean that he already is. You know, where I think he can get to, where I think a lot of people think he can get to, helps them get up another level. So I think that that's sort of something that I'm factoring into my thoughts, that if anybody's going to jump up and take it, Beal plays into that a lot.
The Bulls are sort of similar to Miami to me, but I think their floor is higher.
Bobby Portis!
Yes, that whether he plays or not is going to be, I'm not sure, but I still do love him.
Bobby Portis should play all of the minutes.
Swing.
Like, they should just play 1-on-5 Bobby Portis against everybody.
They need to swing one of their front court players into a guard that can...
There's an obvious candidate, but you're probably going to think it's a different person than me.
Noah.
You're gonna say it's Noah, and I'm gonna say it's Taj Gibson.
Yeah, I don't think it's crazy that Noah's just done.
I think that's a little bit crazy. I think if you manage it better, you know, keep his minutes around 25 or so a night, sort of Bogut style. Let him play defense. Don't give him quite as much offensive responsibility. Use Mirotić at the four more often. Get Bobby Portis in there. You'll keep Noah healthier.
You can have Gibson's contract runs longer. He's cheaper. You don't have to re-sign him after this year. Like, from a going forward standpoint, it makes more sense to keep Gibson at the locked-in price than having to re-sign Noah to a 4-year deal.
That's fair, but it's still only 1 year. You got to re-sign Taj after that. I also think you might be able to get more value for him because he's got less of an injury history and is signed for an extra year.
Yes, but the way the league works, though, it wouldn't surprise me, even with that context, if you got more for Noah, even coming
That's
off
fair.
The year he is.
That's fair enough.
Just the way these teams, some teams, look at things.
What do you think of, you know, Jimmy Butler, obviously, last season, his leap offensively was so big, and I know the guys at Nylon Calculus are actually looking into this for a future post. How likely is he to sustain that offensive growth? Because, you know, there's a lot of people that are basically just assuming that that's there to stay and more. Like, that he'll just get better again. You know, improvement doesn't always work like that. It's not just linear where, you know, he got all that much better last year, so he's automatically got that and is still going to add this year. What do you think about the likelihood that he stays at the level he was offensively and better?
I don't know about better. He got really freaking good. I think if there is any drop-off, it's not enough that it craters his game. I don't think we see him go back to... Here's like, okay, there's a couple things. Maybe one, maybe the jump isn't as much as it really looked like because of the season he was coming off with the injuries. So maybe his play wasn't as down and the extremes weren't as far, so it was a less of a jump than we realize. Two, even if he either plateaus at what he was last year or he dips a little bit, that's still an all-star caliber player.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So,
especially if he keeps up, you know, which I mean you would assume he keeps up his defense, which is just, I mean, absurd.
Yeah, I liked him coming out of Marquette. I never foresaw this.
I don't think anybody foresaw this. I mean, there's a reason that he went, 30th in the draft?
Yeah, he was somewhere.
Anybody foresaw, you know, him basically becoming, I don't even know what the comp would be.
One of the best two guards in the league. Wherever you want to rank him is up to you. I don't really, doesn't
or
really
just
matter to me.
One of the best wings in the league.
Yeah.
Not necessarily just two guards.
Yeah, I remember watching him early on. I was like, oh, this guy's going to be kind of good. I like his game.
Yeah.
And then he did this, which, no, I'm not pretending like I had any idea was going to happen. The Hawks and Raptors. Let's start with the Raptors. Are they kind of doing the same? Is it fair to say they're kind of doing the same thing that Indiana is, except with more talent, and maybe not to the complete extreme that Indiana's trying to do?
Yeah, I'd say it's similar, and I do agree that they have more talent, simply because they have so much more front court talent. You know, Jonas and Patrick Patterson. Even Luis Scola, James Johnson as sort of a small ball forward type.
Anthony Bennett.
I'm not including him on that. Even Biombo can come in and play defense for 10-15 minutes. I like their... So yeah, that's a good description actually. Except they have, you know, more dependable front court players. And I think they have guys more suited to being small ball fours in James Johnson and Damari Carroll than Paul George might be.
So what do you think on three out of every four nights when you don't have someone maybe who's going off, what do you think is their closing lineup?
Lowry, DeRozan, Carroll, Jonas... Probably Patterson. I mean, I think that the way they start, I assume that's the way they're going to start games, and I think that's the way they'll finish them unless there's sort of a specific lineup reason that they want to go small and have Ross out there with Carroll at the four, or have, you know, Johnson out there and have him and Carroll sort of play combo forward together. You know, maybe they'll go super small and have Patterson next to Carroll in the front court against some teams. They can do a lot of different things.
You could do the two point guards with Corey Joseph, too, if they wanted to.
Yeah, yep.
I like Patterson. I think he's a good player.
I really like Patterson. You know, Amir Johnson's really good, but Patterson gives them a little bit of a different look with his stretchiness. I think he was up somewhere near like 4 or 5 threes per 36 minutes last season.
He wasn't, and Amir could shoot a little bit, but I would be more open to living with Amir Johnson beating me on the offensive end than Patrick Patterson. Like, I'm going to want to close out on Patterson's three-point shootings shots. Amir Johnson, I would let shoot.
Yeah, and Amir's got range to the elbows or so. Patterson's got range to the three-point line.
He's
a better defender. They give you different looks.
He took almost 5 threes per 36 minutes last year, shot 37%. The year before, he shot 41%. Patterson's a 37% three-point shooter. And I think when you're playing with someone like DeMar DeRozan, it's important to have that type of shooting from at least three of the other positions. And with Carroll, Patterson, and Lowry, you're getting that now.
What do you think of Terrence Ross? You know, I thought he sort of, not necessarily regressed, but more like plateaued last year.
He's a better version of Tim Hardaway Jr. to me. He's a guy who, and what I mean by that, he's a guy who looks like a basketball player. He runs, he jumps, he has his shot looks smooth. And everything looks like, and you think he's going to pop, and you think he's going to end up being good, but something just doesn't translate, and he's not as good as you think he can be.
I think he's just sort of spacey, if that makes sense, where he has these lapses where you just forget that he's on the court, because he's just totally uninvolved.
It's the Rudy Gay criticism coming out of college,
which wound up being completely off when he was in the pros because he wound up overasserting himself and trying to take all the shots. But yes, it is the Rudy Gay criticism coming out of college.
And I think Ross is fine. And signing Carroll, what's good, it'll end up being good for him, is that it allows him to play his proper role, and he's young enough that there's still an outside chance that he gets better, but in all likelihood, I think he probably just is what he is, and he's a guard that comes off the bench, can get hot for you some nights, and you ride him those nights he gets hot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having him come off the bench may work out better for him, because he's not counted on to do quite as much, he's not playing against the same caliber of players. So it might, you know, give him a little bit of a spark.
All right, so from the team that has Damari Carroll to the team that lost him, the Atlanta Hawks, how do you think they have the capability of replacing him?
Not with one guy. I think it'll be sort of a combination, and you try to approximate his impact with, you know, 4 or 5 different guys between Tabo and Bazemore and Justin Holiday and Tim Hardaway. I think that between those four guys, you can approximate the shooting with some and the defense with others.
It's too bad they couldn't, like, merge all four of those guys into one player. Then you'd be onto something.
Like, if they could merge Tabo and Hardaway into one player, where you have a player with a quick release that shoots. And I say a quick release because Hardaway has a quick release, but Tabo has maybe the slowest release in the league. You have a quick release that shoots, you know, slightly above average from three and plays above average defense, because you take Tabo's good defense and Hardaway's awful defense and merge it into a slightly above average. You have a slightly above average guy on both ends.
I would have put Hardaway and Holiday together.
don't think Holiday is quite as good defensively as Tabo's.
Yeah, I know, but I like Holiday.
I like Holiday a lot, too. This is something that I wrote about for the Cauldron, too, like where, you know, the big question that the non-Cavs East teams are facing, and for the Hawks, it was, you know, how do they make up for losing Carroll? They could do it by going big, too, I think, rather than small lineups. You know, Horford and Splitter with Millsap at the three.
How do you think Millsap's the shooting, he has to be a little more trigger happy from three in those scenarios. But how does
he's played three before. He did it in Utah.
How does he do defensively in those situations? You think he holds up okay?
I think it could work against certain teams.
And then Korver, is he fully ready to go at this point?
I'm never going to doubt that Kyle Korver's ready to shoot.
Yeah, and then you got Teagan Schroeder.
Skateboard Diggy.
I think Schroeder. I think he still gets better. I think he makes another. I don't know how big of a jump.
Yeah, I think he gets better too. Shout out to Danny Chow for alerting me to that Skateboard D nickname. By the way,
wait, what's his nickname?
Skateboard D.
I missed that. When did that happen?
It's not a wildly popular nickname, but I love it.
And skateboard, that's way easier to say, so I'm always in favor of that.
Yeah, he has like a crew of skateboarders that he's part of.
So he's like the Little Wayne of the NBA with skateboarding.
I guess.
I like Mike Muscala, and I'm seeing, I don't know if he's actually on the team, on the Basketball Insider page, Earl Barron is on their roster right now, so that
Earl Barron, like former New York Knicks great Earl Barron,
and
not
Phoenix
great at all,
and Phoenix Suns great. So that means they're automatic. They go jump into the contender category for me. Then I put the Suns beat writer for the Arizona Republic, Paul Coro. Every time I saw him last year, I would ask him to write a feature on Earl Barron, and he ignored me the entire time.
Well, I can't say that Earl Barron is exactly feature-worthy.
Watch your mouth.
Sorry, man.
How could you say such a thing? Very, very feature-worthy. All right, but on a serious note, let's... Mike Scott, well, don't drive and do ecstasy, idiot. He can shoot lots of threes, too, though, but yeah.
And he has emoji tattoos.
So he has a lot going for him outside the driving and doing drugs part. That's not so good.
Don't drive and drink or do drugs.
Yeah, that's our...
You can do those things if you want to, just, like, not together.
Yes. Exactly. We're not asking for much here. You can do all the drugs you want, just not while driving. All right.
Don't do drugs, kids.
Good save. All right, the Cavs.
This is the only real contender for me.
Yes, and is it even... Yeah, they are real contenders. I think they're the one team, if everything breaks right, that could beat a team in the West.
Yeah, I don't see any of the other Eastern Conference teams being able to do that. And I don't really think any of the Eastern Conference teams can beat Cleveland if they're healthy.
It would take a LeBron James injury. I think that's pretty much the only way they do not get to the NBA Finals.
Yeah. How many games do you think they lose on the way to the Finals? I think last year they lost one, right? Or two?
Well, they went to game six with the Bulls, right?
Right, but they didn't lose to Boston. And did they lose to Atlanta?
I think they did. I think they did. I don't think they swept them. Hold on. Let's see. My computer doesn't like me today. The internet.
No, they swept Atlanta.
Did they sweep Atlanta in the Eastern Conference Finals? Okay, I was wrong about that. So they lost two games.
Yeah.
Both to the Bulls.
I think they lose one game on the way to the Finals this year.
I think Washington's the one team that is an intriguing matchup for them to make.
Yeah, I think they lose 4-1 in the Conference Finals.
All right. Anything else with the Eastern Conference you would like to add?
I mean, you know, the Knicks, they're going to kill us both.
If Galloway and Grant play enough and are decent, they can be okay. If I have to watch Sasha, Fisher's going to already throw me off the edge of a cliff playing Sasha Vujicic in the preseason.
Fisher did say that he's basically doing that sort of as a placeholder because he knows Flavio's going to start in that spot, and he wants Galloway and Grant to get used to playing together off the bench.
I know, but I've already watched Sasha Vujicic play like 30 minutes of basketball this season. That's 30 minutes too many.
And I talked about this on Nate Duncan's podcast with Jason, our friend Jason Concepcion. And, you know, I think Jason was the one that said the actual line. Sasha is still not afraid to let it fly.
No,
the machine isn't working.
Oh, boy. Him and Calgary in the backcourt together, it just hurts my eyes.
The slowest backcourt in history.
Yeah, and the front court's actually an NBA level front court. I like that they're, if they want to, they can keep Melo right around 32 minutes this year pretty easily. They have enough.
Yeah, I think Fisher has mentioned wanting to cut down on his playing time too. So
he said that last year, and that ended real quick. And they even did it at the very beginning last year, and then that whole idea just died. And even when he was playing on
right, they, at the beginning of the season, they weren't playing him the entire first quarter.
Yeah.
And then of course he got hurt, and they started playing him.
All right, that's enough Knicks talk. All right, that's good. That's our Eastern Conference preview. We're going to be right back at you with the Western Conference and then some predictions.